Happy to see you all today and share my thoughts with you. Meditation, of course, is an effort to be free of our emotional excitements. That's the main thing. You see, when we think of the modern theories about animals and human beings, we are aware of the theory of evolution given by Charles Darwin. And one important thing about this modern ways of thinking is that what is special about the human being is the ability to think and reason out. Because the brain of the human being is more evolved, and what is special is this ability to think and reason out. And emotion is something that we share with animals. That is the animal nature within us. And so, the teaching of the Buddha is the teaching about the evolution of the human being, how the human being can evolve beyond this level. Today we are aware that the modern human being has developed a thing called science and scientific technology. The modern human being is aware of the world, how things happen in the world. In ancient times, people thought the world and natural phenomena were really caused by spirits, good or bad. The good spirits were called gods and the bad spirits were called devils. But the modern research into the workings of the natural phenomena, they have realized one important fact, and that is called determinism. Determinism simply means that everything that occurs in the world occurs due to the presence of the necessary conditions. When certain conditions are present, a certain thing happens. And if one condition is absent, it won't happen. So this is the meaning of determinism. But in the West, this idea of determinism came into being somewhere after the 15th century, when science evolved. But long time before that, it was the Buddha who brought this idea into the world. That is what is today translated as dependent origination or paticca samuppada. And this is why in Buddhism we don't speak about gods and devils. We speak about how things happen due to the presence of the necessary conditions. This is what is special about Buddhism. And it was not only that, today some religions are trying to go against the modern discoveries of science like the theory of evolution. But when we think of Buddhism, Buddhism is confirming that. And this idea of evolution is what Buddha is trying to achieve. Not only trying to achieve, he achieved it. In other words, when we speak of the Buddha, we are speaking about the highest evolved state of the human being. When the human being, today we hear of Superman, but this is just a fiction today. But during the time of the Buddha, Superman was a reality. Even now we hear of yogis who perform certain things which are wonderful, and this is due to certain psychic powers that a human being could develop. And so Superman really existed during the time of the Buddha. But the Buddha went beyond that state in becoming a Buddha. Buddha means an awakened one. Awakening is something superior to having psychic powers. That awakening is the awakening from a dream of existence. We are all thinking that we exist, but we are not really existing. And not only that, our whole idea of existence is an illusion. This is what the Buddha pointed out. And when we think about ourselves, that is also an illusion. And all our self-centered behavior is really due to our emotions. When we think of the mind, there are two main parts of the mind, the thinking, reasoning part and the emotional part. It was the emotional part that the Buddha called chitta, and the thinking part he called mano. So, what is really happening is that our thinking part is aware of the world, and we are also aware that everything in the world is impermanent because everything is dependent on conditions. Whatever is dependent on conditions is unstable. Just as a piece of ice, the presence of the ice is dependent on conditions, especially the temperature. When the temperature changes, the ice turns into water. And if the temperature becomes even hotter than that, the water turns into water vapor and becomes invisible. So like that, everything is dependent on conditions. Even our life is dependent on conditions. And when those conditions, even one condition is absent, life stops. So this is the meaning of life, that everything is dependent on conditions. And what is dependent on conditions is unstable. But our emotions are blind, and our emotions want something which is not realistic. It is our emotions that want permanence in this impermanent world. Our thinking, reasoning tells us that everything is impermanent. But our emotion says, no, we want permanence. So there is a conflict between our emotions and our reason. And it is this conflict that is creating all the unhappiness in the world. All the unhappiness which the Buddha called dukkha, today translated as suffering. It's not just suffering, it's the unhappiness that arises from this conflict between our emotions and reality that we are aware of. And the other thing that the Buddha saw was that there is no self within us, although we think and feel that there is a self. And that feeling of self, although we can even think and reason out and realize that there is no self inside us, but still we feel there is a self. That feeling is coming from the emotions, because the emotions are blind. So it is by getting rid of the emotions that our unhappiness and our illusions can disappear. This is what the Buddha called tanha. Tanha is the emotion, today translated as craving. It's not just craving, it is the emotion that is producing this problem really. It is the cause of the problem. And so it is by getting rid of emotions that this unhappiness can be brought to an end. So when we speak about meditation, we are really speaking about getting rid of emotions. Now, getting rid of emotion doesn't mean that we fight with the emotions. Now, people, modern psychologists like Sigmund Freud, recognize this problem. And he saw that emotions cannot be got rid of by expression or suppression or repression. But he thought the best way is sublimation, which means to gratify the emotions in a socially acceptable way. In other words, he did not understand how emotions could be completely removed. Although he thought that is the best thing to do, but he thought these emotions are built into us, that they are instinctive, and therefore they cannot be removed. But the Buddha saw that the emotions can be removed. And what he saw was that emotions are really disturbances of the mind. The mind in its natural state, or its original state, is pure and tranquil. It is the disturbance of the mind, and not only the mind, even the body itself is disturbed when an emotional arousal takes place. And therefore, the only way to get rid of emotions is to relax the body and calm the mind. And this is the meaning of meditation. Learn to relax the body and calm the mind. Now this is easily said than done. But the thing is, if we want to calm the mind, we can't just sit and calm the mind. First, we have to calm our behavior. If our behavior is not calm, the mind cannot be calm. So therefore, first we have to learn to control our behavior. And that is what is called sila. Sila is the control of behavior. And samadhi is the purification of the mind, which means removing the mind of emotional excitement, emotional disturbance. That means calming the mind. So calming the mind is samadhi. Today, wrongly translated as concentration. Concentration is not the way to calm the mind. Mind can be calmed only by learning to relax the body and to relax the breathing and also to learn to stop reacting to stimulation. That means we have to stop reacting to what we see, what we hear, what we smell, what we taste, what we touch, and even what we think about. So, that is the meaning of samatha bhavana, which is also called tranquility meditation. Now, it is only when the mind is fully tranquil that the mind can think clearly. And cultivation of the thinking part of the mind is what is called vipassana or insight meditation. When we speak of insight meditation, we are really referring to cultivating the thinking part of the mind. So this is in short the meaning of meditation, and I hope you understood. And if there is any question you would like to ask, I would be very happy to try to answer it. Thank you.
Why you thought that focusing on the breathing was not so good was because of getting an intrahepatic state, this sort of thing. And if that's the case, then how do you focus on the body and relax the breath and so forth if you're not one-pointed on the breath or on place in the body where the breath is?
Yeah, that's a good question. What I'm trying to say is that relaxing the breathing is what we should do and not try to concentrate on the breathing. These are two different things. Concentrating on the breathing can only put you into what is called the hypnotic state. That most people who practice concentration just enter the hypnotic state and they also begin to hallucinate as a result. But if you simply think of relaxing the body and relaxing the breathing, you don't concentrate on the breath. You are focusing on the whole body, not one particular place like the nostril or even the abdomen rising and falling, but the whole body. And you are relaxing the whole body as you breathe in and as you breathe out. That is how it should be done. other questions? You're going?
Everyone has to do that.
Thank you so much.
Yeah?
Today you suggest that the meditation of the Buddha is free of emotion.
Can you say it a little louder?
Today you emphasize the main teaching of the Buddha to free our emotional cycles. Last time you suggested when we were here, the objective is to become a good person, is a way to become awakened. So could you
elaborate? I couldn't get
attention.
I didn't hear you properly. Can you say it again a little louder? Did you hear what he said?
Yeah, I think he said that last time when you were here in September or October, you talked about how cultivating, being a good person leads to awakening.
Uh-huh.
And today he mentioned, you continue what you said earlier, that the path is really about, did you say, getting rid of the emotions? Free from the emotions is the way. He wants you to explain how the two are the same, like how being a good person is the same as getting rid of the emotions.
Ah, I see. Well, being a good person and being free of emotion is the same thing. Because it is the emotions that make you a bad person. Because the emotions are all self-centered. And when you are self-centered, you become a bad person. When we say a bad person, it means that person comes in conflict with other people and inconsiderate of others and that sort of thing, which is all due to the self-centered emotions. So when the emotions are absent, that self-centeredness disappears and we can become interested in others. We become interested in that others are as important as ourselves. But when we are self-centered, then we become more important than others. That is the reason. So, to become a good person is to be free of these self-centered emotions. Now, there is another problem here because some people think that there are good emotions. Now, that is a mistake. This is a Western concept, really. The good emotions, that means they speak of love. That word love is a very misleading word. It was a psychologist called Eric Fromm who wrote a book called The Art of Loving. And there he pointed out that the word, English word love, is used for various things. And so he used three Greek words to point out what is going on. The three Greek words were eros, philia, and agape. Eros is what is called sexual love. Now, when people speak about sexual intercourse, they say making love. You see, there love is given a completely different meaning. And philia refers to family love between brothers and sisters, parents and children, that sort of thing, which is an attachment. It is self-centered also. And the other is agape, which is the selfless love, which in Buddhism we call metta or maitri. And that is the selfless love, which we find also in Christianity as love thy neighbor as thyself. There again, that selfless love. And that is the real love, which is not self-centered. And that is an interest in the welfare of all beings, without excluding anyone, without any distinction between oneself and others. May all beings be well, comfortable, peaceful and happy. That is metta. And there you are not referring to one individual or a group of individuals, but for all beings without exception. So that is the selfless love, but that is not an emotion. It is only in the absence of emotions that that kind of love can be practiced. So this is what I was trying to say. Did you understand that?
I could add something about it, because it's confusing, because we use the word emotion in different ways, and I think actually the original meaning of emotion is that idea of movement. And so when we move towards selfless love, there's a quality of stillness that's not like the mind isn't agitated like it is when we see somebody who we're attracted to and want to connect with them.
Yeah. The stillness of the mind. So it's not really an emotion, yeah.
But we use it differently. I mean, but I understand why technically it's probably better not to use emotions. Like sometimes we'll say the Brahma Viharas or the sublime emotions. But emotion, I think, technically means something's in motion. And so when we're touching metta, there's a still quality of stillness.
Yes, the Brahma Vihara cannot be called the sublime emotion. Yeah, it's incorrect to say that. It's not a sublime emotion. You can't say a sublime state of the mind.
You can't say that.
You can say that it is a sublime state of the mind, but it is incorrect to say it is a sublime emotion. Yeah. Because that is a mind free of emotion. Metta, karuna, mudita, and upekkha.
Following up on the discussion about how we equally try to strive to love the others in their selfless way or non-self-centered way, I'm wondering, then, why would Buddhist tradition still maintain a specific kind of hierarchy?
What is the last thing you said?
Why doesn't Buddhist tradition maintain a hierarchy within it itself?
Hierarchy. Hierarchy. Mm-hmm. What is the hierarchy that you find in Buddhism?
Because there are certain people who are treated in very differently from lay people. For example, you are monk and we respect you and so forth, right? The way in which we treat you is very different. And there's a sense of a hierarchy, right? I think it's a fair way to say that.
Well, the hierarchy is not a hierarchy of that type. This is, say, you are trying to climb a mountain. Flight of steps. You see a lower step and you see a higher step and going up. So on the path, if you are trying to go up, the up is higher than the down, you
see.
So that is what it is. It's not a hierarchy of the type where one is superior to the other. But it is superior only in the sense that it is a high level. So if you are, Buddhism is not a sudden jump from the lower to the top. It's a gradual process of development. It's a process of evolution. So we are mainly thinking in those terms. So a monk or a monastic is practicing the teaching of the Buddha at a higher level than the householder. You see, you have to understand that the important thing is to give up these emotional attachments. And the layman is fully attached emotionally to your family, your husband, your wife, your children, and your properties and everything, you see, these attachments. Whereas a monk or a monastic has given up all these things. They are itself at a high level. In this ladder, if you are trying to climb a ladder, that is a higher level in the ladder. And so, in order to reach that higher level, it is important to have that, what you call the sense of values. That means you have to value that higher level. If you think that higher level is a low thing and that you don't think it is great, then you won't be going in that direction. So, the worship and the bowing and all that is a psychological part of the practice, which is to honor what you want to get. It's like if you want to become a millionaire, you always consider millionaires as great people, otherwise you won't be trying to become a millionaire. Or if you want to get a degree in the university, you have to consider the PhD or something as greater than just a lower level of education. If you don't think in that way, you will never go up. So in order to rise, you have to appreciate the value of the higher level. That is why the kind of bowing and appreciation given to them. It's not a hierarchy.
Could you share a little bit about working through the emotion of the fear of death?
Fear of death. Death. Yeah.
Practice with ways of thinking that through.
What's that?
With practice or ways of thinking through that emotion?
Well, the fear of death is the ultimate fear that you have to, that is really the basic fear. But it is gradually given up by realizing that you don't even exist. If you don't exist, how can you die? You see? So it is only when you realize that you don't exist that the fear of death disappears completely. That is how the insight brings that to an end.
Are you speaking of anatta?
What's that?
Are you speaking of anatta, that there's no self, or that we literally don't exist?
Yeah,
the
anatta.
The aggregates exist, but the self doesn't.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But you have to say it loud. Because I can't.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now I can hear.
If I may read to you a sutra, a short one.
Yeah.
I'll have a question for you.
Yeah.
This sutra has a title, A Better Way to Live Alone.
Better Way to Live Alone.
Yes. I think we may forget it, but for this audience, I'd like to read to them so they know what they are.
Yeah.
And I'll ask you a question.
Yeah.
Is that all right with you? Do not pursue the past. Do not lose yourself in the future. The past no longer is. The future has no yet come. Looking deeply at life as it is, in the very here and now, the practitioner dwells in stability and freedom. We must diligently today to wait until tomorrow is too late. Death comes unexpectedly. How can we bargain with it? The sage calms a person who knows how to dwell in mindfulness night and day is the one who knows the better way to live alone. My question is that, what does the Buddha mean by mindfulness?
Now, first of all, I like to know from where you got that sutra.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like the Buddha's statement.
It's the same sutra, Bhante, as One Fortunate Attachment. I think Bhante,
what's that?
Bhikkhu Bodhi, I think, translates that sutta. The title of the sutta is One Fortunate Attachment.
What?
One Fortunate Attachment.
One Fortunate Attachment?
Yeah.
What is the fortunate attachment?
Yeah, I think that's how it's translated. Or at least some. Somebody, I thought it was Bhikkhu Bodhi translated that rightly. I can find out where it comes from if it's important. I have it. You're great.
But anyway, essentially I got it from my Zen master, Thipnathan. And he suggests this is a sutra that was read by, taught by the Buddha, how to live alone in the forest. He taught this particular sutra to a monk. And the key word that I'd like to learn from there is the word mindfulness. Which is the inside meditation we're talking about
here. Can you give me that so that I can look at it? Yeah. Now I understood that. Okay, thank you. Sit.
Yeah. Unfortunate attachment.
Yeah, I know this, yeah.
So the question here is that
what is the question?
By mindfulness in this particular sutra.
Yeah?
They're asking us to dwell in day and night, 24 hours a day.
Yeah?
When we live in mindfulness.
Yeah.
So can you shine into what does it mean by mindfulness, day and night?
Well, very important to understand this, but this translation is misleading. You see, even the word mindfulness is a word that I don't like. The word sati is used and the word sati is translated as mindfulness today. Because some persons translated it like that, and everyone else is just blindly following that translation. This is what has happened. The word sati is really attention. Attention. And we have this word, there are two kinds of attention, samma sati and mitcha sati. And samma sati is what we are interested in. Samma sati is the correct attention, mitcha sati is the wrong attention. So attention can be focused in the right way or the wrong way. And this right way is also called satipatthana. Satipatthana is really a short form of sati upatthana. Two words combined together, sati and upatthana. Upatthana means to focus within, inside. The attention should be focused within, not outside. That is the real meaning of satipatthana. It is not just mindfulness. Attention focused within. Now why it is done is, normally, now I told you the first thing is that we have to get rid of the emotions. That is the first point. To understand. We are trying to get rid of emotions. And we have to understand that emotions come not from inside out, as Freud thought. Buddha pointed out that the emotions come from outside in. This is the difference between the teachings of the Buddha and Freud's thinking. You see, emotions coming from outside in means it starts with the stimulation of the senses. If you see something beautiful, you are attracted to it. If you see something ugly, you are repelled by it. If you hear something beautiful, you are attracted to it. If you hear something ugly, you are repelled by it. If you smell something pleasant, you are attracted to it. If you smell something unpleasant, you are repelled by it. This is the reaction of an organism to environmental stimulation. This is how you have to understand. We are all organisms in an environment. And the environment stimulates our senses and we react to it. So this is why the Buddha said, take your attention away from what you see, what you hear, what you smell, what you taste, what you touch, and even what you think about. That is called guarding the senses. Indriya Samvara, guarding the senses. Having withdrawn your attention from these external objects, now focus within. And when you focus within, what are you becoming aware of? You are becoming aware of the reaction. In other words, instead of focusing on the object to which you react, focus on the reaction itself. That is what it is. Now, here, what he calls solitude is focusing on the present. Not to think of the past, not to think of the future, focus on the present, but not on what is seen in the present, or what is heard or smelt or tasted, but what is going on inside you. So this is what is called introspection in modern psychology. So this thing called sati really is not mindfulness, it is introspection. So you have to be constantly introspective. So to practice mindfulness all the time means that every moment you should be focusing within and not outside. It is only when you keep on doing that, that the mind calms down and also you gain the insight. Now there are two things that we should become aware of. What is called vijnana. The word vijnana is also badly translated today as consciousness. Vijnana is not consciousness. Vijnana is perception or cognition. That is what vijnana is. So, chakku vijnana is eye perception, sota vijnana is ear perception, gana vijnana is nose perception, jivha vijnana is tongue perception, kaya vijnana is body perception, and there is mind perception which is called mano vijnana, and that mano vijnana is what is called cognition. So it is cognition that is translated, I mean that is the correct translation for vijnana. And now the vijnana or this cognition is really focused on external things. What we see, what we hear, what we smell, what we taste, what we touch. That's what we are focusing on. That is, but here the Buddha says, take your attention away from those things and focus within and see how you are reacting all the time. Now that focusing within is divided into four. Kayanupassana, Vedananupassana, Chittanupassana, Dhammanupassana. Kayanupassana is focusing on the body. Vedananupassana is focusing on the sensations. And Chittanupassana is focusing on the emotions. And Dhammanupassana is focusing on the thoughts. So that is all going on inside. And focusing on the body really means observing the reactions in the body to what you see, hear, smell, taste, touch. How your body is reacting, you can become aware of it. Then you can become aware of the sensations in the body. There you are really becoming aware of the tensions that arise in the body as you are reacting to things. Then you become aware of the emotions that are aroused as you react. Then you become aware of the thoughts that come to your mind as you react. So the reaction occurs first as a thought, and then as an emotion, and the emotion leads to physical tension in the body and the movements of the body. And then of course it leads to action, which is the release of tension. So that's how it happens. So you have to become aware of that whole reaction in that way. And by constantly becoming aware of this reaction, that the reaction stops. Because the reaction is an unconscious process. You are not consciously doing it. It is happening to you unconsciously. And it can be stopped only by becoming conscious of that. So what Freud spoke about as the unconscious, there is some truth in that, from a Buddhist point of view. And it is that unconsciousness that is called avijja, today badly translated as ignorance. It is not ignorance, it is unconsciousness. We are not conscious of the reactions. So it is only when we become conscious that the reaction stops. So that is how that mindfulness leads to the awakening. Did you understand that?
That if I may follow up, we have the same question. About the objective. Instead of being an objective, being a good person, being an objective, and being rid of the emotion, but the main objective of Buddhism that I learn about is that to get into a state that's called nirvana. So what's your understanding of the word nirvana? What's your explanation?
I didn't follow him. Can you tell me what he said?
Well, I think the gist of what he's asking is what he mentioned that you talk about calming the emotions or
Yeah.
the emotions.
Yeah.
And then he's wanting to know about the state of nirvana or nibbana and how that relates to the stilling or the getting rid of emotions.
Now, nibbana has been defined by the Buddha as raga khayo, dosa khayo, moha khayo, nibbana. That means raga, dosa and moha. It's the same thing as lobha, dosa and moha. Lobha is the attraction that I spoke of. Dosa is the repulsion that I spoke of. And moha is the confusion of the mind by the emotions. When you are emotionally excited, you can't think straight. Now that is the moha. So with that moha comes the idea of self, the thought I am, the thought of self. That is all moha. So to be free of this is the nirvana. That's the meaning of nirvana. So it is the complete removal of the emotions to such an extent that it will not come back again. It's not a temporary removal of the emotions. It's a permanent removal of the emotions. That is me, Ron.
I have a question about, you spoke of the removal of the emotions. Will bringing attention, allowing ourselves to observe and have our attention be on our reactions to eliminate those emotions, or will it just allow us to be with them in a way that doesn't involve attachment or repulsion?
Well, removal of emotion and being free of attraction and repulsion is the same thing.
Okay.
So it is the removal of emotion.
So if you, because, you know, at this point, I kind of can't conceive of what it would be like not to experience emotion, but I can conceive of what it would be like to not be involved with my emotions.
Oh yes, at this point, you can't suddenly be free of emotion.
I can never
experience it.
Right.
Yes, that is true. But at this point, what you can do is to become aware of the reactions. Mm-hmm. And then gradually you will come to a point where you will be free of emotion.
Okay. That is a possibility.
Yeah.
Say something about where you live and where you're
going
in America.
You
know, how long you've been
about?
Like I didn't
hear you.
I was wondering where do you live?
Where I live?
Yeah, how long have you been about?
Oh, I have been in the United States for about 35 years now. I came in 1970. So, I have been a monk for at least about 40 years.
Where do you live now? These
days, I don't live in one place. During winter time, I am either in Los Angeles or I go to Sri Lanka. And then, summertime, I'm mainly in this area. And sometimes in Canada. So I am most of the time in Canada and United States. Why do you ask that question?
curiosity.
Curiosity.
A lot of books in Minnesota.
Going back to translating Pali terms.
Yeah.
I understood. I think it's the word sanya. I've heard that translated
sanya
as perception.
No, sanya is not perception.
What is that?
You see, this is the problem. Many, many people who, really the original people who translated certain things, they made mistakes. But the later translators all use the same translation and continue. They never try to find out whether that is the right translation. This is the problem.
What was the word that you said was perception?
No, the thing is, I studied psychology. And so, I know how the modern psychologists use the word perception. And then, if you use the word perception to refer to something in Pali, then what is meant in Pali is something else. And people use the word perception, the reader is misled. That's what happens.
What would you say is sanya then?
Well, I will explain those words, not only word sanya. There are five words that you have to understand. Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankhara, Vinyana. These are normally translated as the five aggregates. That is also a useless translation. The word five aggregates. It doesn't convey any meaning, you see. You see, this is, first we have to understand the word experience. As it is used by modern Western philosophers, the word experience. Now, so that is also not easy to explain, the word experience. Experience is seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, feeling, all that is experience. That is what experience is. Now when we talk about experience, this experience has two aspects. The objective and the subjective. Now when I look at you, you are all objects to me. And when I think of myself, that is a subjective experience. For you also, when you look at me, I am an object to you. But when you look at yourself, that is subject. Right? So when we speak of experience, we are thinking of an objective experience and a subjective experience. Now if you are thinking of a pain in your back or pain somewhere else, it is a subjective experience. I can never feel the pain that you have. Only you can feel it. Therefore it is your subjective experience. A thought that arises in your mind, that is also a subjective experience. Right? So, these five things, Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vinyana, which are called aggregates, are really how the Buddha analyzed experience into five parts. The experience was analyzed. Now the objective part of the experience is what is called rupa. Rupa is the objective part of the experience. Then Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana, all four are the subjective part of the experience. In other words, the subjective part has been analyzed into four parts and the objective part is just one thing, rupa, there. Right? So, now when we speak of the Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana, we are really speaking about the subjective experience of the objective experience. Now when I say this, you have to understand that even the objective experience, although you say it is something outside there, it is not something outside there. That we have to understand. What I see as an object is really in my mind. It's a picture in my mind. Although I think it is there, it is really here. So it's a mental image. That is called the perceptual image. And that is what we call rupa. But it is seen as an object. And then how did that come into being? Through this process, Vedana. Vedana really refers to a feeling. A feeling of comfort or discomfort. That is the Vedana. Or a neutral feeling. When you look at the wall, you don't feel pleasure or pain. But if you see a beautiful flower, you might be pleased and So it is a pleasant feeling. Or if you see something ugly, it is an unpleasant feeling. So you see, the feelings have three kinds. The pleasant, the unpleasant, and the neutral. That is the Vedana. Vedana is of three kinds. Sukha, Dukkha, Adukkha Masukha. Adukkha Masukha means neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Then comes Sanya. Sanya refers to what psychologists call sensation. Now when we open our eyes, what do we really see? Can you say what you really see? Usually you see an object, huh? But you never see an object. What you see is color, nothing else. There are seven colors, the rainbow colors. Those are the colors that you see. Because in our eye, there is a place called the retina. You are aware of that. And in that retina, there are nerve endings. Many nerve endings. And each nerve ending detects only one wavelength of light. Light comes in different wavelengths or frequencies. And one wavelength produces the color violet. Another wavelength produces the color indigo. The other wavelength produces the color blue. The other one yellow. The other one orange. The other one red. So like that we have seven colors, violet, indigo, blue, green, yellow, orange, red. But these are all different wavelengths. And each nerve ending is able to detect only one wavelength. And therefore, what you really see is color, nothing else. What you really see is color. And seeing colors is sanya. When you speak of sanya, you are really speaking of colors that you see when you are thinking of what you see. When you hear, that is also a sensation. Through the ears, then you hear sounds of different kinds. The sounds are also of different kinds like that you see. And smells are also of different kinds. Tastes are also of different kinds. The touch is also of different kinds. And that is the sanya. Then comes sankhara. Sankhara is where we combine these colors and think of an object. Now, when a painter paints a picture, how does that painter do that? Takes different colors and puts the colors on the,
canvas.
Huh?
Canvas.
What?
Canvas.
Carol?
Canvas.
Canvas, yeah. Canvas. Yes. Yes, you put the paint on the canvas. That is all that the artist or painter does. But you go and look at it and then you produce the picture in your mind. You interpret those colors you put together in a certain way and you form in your mind, oh, this is a tree or this is a face. Or all that is done by putting together the colors. Now that putting together is what is called sankhara. That is sankhara. Now, having produced objects like that, now what you do is, you begin to see different objects and you begin to distinguish between objects. You differentiate between objects, one object from another object. That is the vijnana. See? That is the meaning of vijnana. So the object that you see outside, which you call rupa, was really produced by this process, the mental process. So the objective experience is really produced through the subjective experience. That is how the Buddha saw it. So what we are talking about is simply an analysis of this experience. Now the objective part also the Buddha analyzed when he spoke about what are called the dhatu, patavi, apo, tejo, vayo, akasa, vijnana. That is how we did that. Patavi refers to the solids. Apo means the liquids. Now when we learn about modern science, we see there are three states of matter: solids, liquids and gas. So these three states of matter, really gas is the thing that came only after science. Normally people don't see gas, because there is gas here, no one sees that. So only the scientists started talking about thing called gas. So normally people are only aware of solids and liquids. This is called space, not gas. So, patavi apo is solids and liquids. Then energy, there is another concept called energy, also brought by the scientist. Before the scientist, people didn't know about energy. So, there again, energy can be in different forms. And today, heat, light, sound, electricity, magnetism, this is all energy, or chemical energy. But the normal person is unaware of all these different kinds of energies. But there are two kinds that the normal person is aware of. And that is fire, or the heat. Heat as energy, and what is called mechanical energy, movement, motion, that is mechanical energy, movement. So those are the two kinds of energy that normally people are aware of. So the Buddha spoke of only those things that normal people are aware of. So the solids, the liquids, the heat and motion, patavi, apo, tejo, vayu, but normally translated as earth, water, fire and air. But this is not earth, water, fire and air that the Buddha spoke of. Solids, liquids, heat and motion. And then akasa. Akasa means empty space. And then vijnana. Vijnana is the same vijnana which was cognition itself. So he has to include cognition because he's talking about the experience. The subjective part of the experience is cognition, and the objective part he analyzed into five there. So in other words, he's simply analyzing experience. And experience is all that we can talk about. That is all that we are aware of.
You seem obviously very well educated in West, not just in your tradition, but in Western philosophy and thought. You have a psychology degree, apparently. What do you think is the advantage of someone like yourself who's been educated in a Buddhist tradition then going and getting a Western education? What is served by that?
What is served by that?
Yes, what is the advantage that is gained?
The advantage is simply that we can understand the teachings of the Buddha better. And also I can explain it to you so that you can understand it also. That is the advantage.
So it's a bridge building.
Yeah, it's a bridge, yeah.
We're going to need to finish up, so if somebody has a question they haven't had a chance to ask, this would be the time.
I would just like to know how to obtain your books.
What's that?
I would like to know how to obtain your writings.
The best thing is to be in touch with our friend, because he will come to know when it is available. And at the moment, some of those books are out of print, and we are planning to get it printed soon. And when it is out, he will know, and our friend here also will know.
We have one copy here, but...
What's that?
I do have one copy that you gave me, and I've already lent it out. Robin just finished reading it, so people can see me, and I can lend out the copy that I have.
Yeah. But that is being edited, and there are some mistakes also in that, and so we have to get it reprinted.
And also you can Google Bhakti Kunichi, and is your website still up? Because there's some articles on your website that people can just download.
Yeah.
It's a lot to pitch in, and it's really, you know, Bhakti, we rarely get to talk in detail about the translations, and I think your point is really a good one about how we're sort of handed the translations, and we just do our best to work with them, and it's really nice when we get people who really reflect deeply on the appropriate translation from Pali to English. It's really helpful to chew on this in this way.
Yeah, yeah.
So thank you very much for that. Thanks again for coming. I hope next year you'll come again and visit us. It was really nice.
Yeah. Oh, yes. When I come this year, we'll be coming and seeing you.
Next day, please, then you stay. You just want to have 3 months.
Oh. So thank you for coming, and we can pay our respects to our monastic leaders here that have been willing to come and spend the day with us. And if you want to leave a donation, you can, again, just remind you there's an envelope that makes a donation home. So thanks again, Bob, thank you for coming.
So nice meeting you all. Hope you'll be able to understand better and improve in your meditations also. So we wish you the blessings of the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org. www.thebuddhaclub.org/donate.